You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaelin Tokawingawa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Lāpare Thursday. My name is Kaelin, I'm your host for today and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whai ake nei, coming up on the show, I speak to Labour's Carmel Cipollone on the abuse and care inquiry and the increase in benefit sanctions under this government. I speak to Justice for Palestine's Kate Stone on the ICJ decision on Israeli apartheid, Timothy Fagden from the University of Auckland on why Biden pulled out of the United States presidential race, and Greenpeace's Sinead O'Flynn on Fonterra's role in delaying international climate action. And for City Councilling today, Sophia speaks to Councillor Shane Henderson about privatising pools and leisure centres and improving public transport. He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai. Text it on 5395 or wire mai rane. Give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e ware ware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō. He pakehere rokiroki mārunga I te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text Lima Toru Iwa Lima 5395 or call in on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fetu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party's Carmel Cipollone.
Yesterday, the Abuse and Care Inquiry Report was released to the public. It came with a set of formal recommendations, including a suggestion for a formal apology from the government, compensation, and new legislation to do with mandatory reporting. Labour leader Chris Hipkins also acknowledged Labour's role in beginning the inquiry and their response to the 2021 interim report, stating, "We didn't do enough and the ball now falls to you and your government." He added that this must be bigger than politics. And data released last week shows the number of benefit sanctions being issued by the government is up 50% compared to this time last year. This has been met with criticism, but the Minister for Social Development says the sanctions are because the government is serious about getting people into work. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I ask about both of these topics, as well as a bill that was dumped yesterday because the minister failed to turn up to its first reading with Labour's Carmel Cipollone. I started by asking about the number of benefit sanctions. The number of benefit sanctions being issued by this government is up 50% from this time last year. What does this mean for beneficiaries?
It means exactly what we thought would happen under this government. There's a punitive approach being taken. They haven't been successful at supporting people into work. In fact, yesterday I was talking about last week's figures, only 297 people on JobSeekers supported into work over the period of a week, which is lower than what happened during the peak of COVID. And so what they seem to be doing is trying to sanction people to get them to leave the benefit. And perhaps that's the way that they're trying to achieve their 50,000 people reduction on benefit. But at the moment, it's abysmal.
The Minister for Social Development says the sanctions are because the government is serious about getting people into work. How much of this do you agree with?
Well, they're not serious about getting people into work because you can see really clearly that they're not exiting people off benefit into work. The Minister was presented with an option and advised by the Ministry for Social Development that rather than choose a target of trying to reduce beneficiaries by 50,000, she should be trying to set a target around exits into employment, which is the outcome that ultimately is the best outcome. But she chose not to choose that as the target and instead went for a reduction. Yesterday in the House, she was talking about the need to ensure that the flow on to benefit is not high, that they're able to slow that down. Well, at the moment, while there's no jobs for people, and people are losing jobs, then you're going to see people come on benefits. So I'm not sure how the minister intends to stop the flow, except for by making it harder for people to access the benefit.
Some criticisms have said this government is locking people into poverty with their sanctions. Would you agree with this?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Also, despite the fact we've had nearly 20,000 more people on benefits since they've taken office, we've seen quite a reduction in the number of hardship grants being given out, which concerns me, because you would assume with more people having to go into welfare, more working New Zealanders who are struggling with the cost of living, that actually the hardship grants would still be high. Instead, we see a decline there. So I'm concerned that those that are on benefit or those that are working but should be eligible for hardship support aren't necessarily getting it. I'm concerned that sanctions are being used as a way of pushing people off benefit. And I'm also concerned that people aren't getting the support that they need to be able to get into employment, because the focus is overall on this kind of punitive approach.
The Abuse and Care Inquiry was released to the public yesterday. What did it tell us?
I think, well, firstly, we just need to acknowledge all of the thousands of survivors who've been waiting for this report, and the over 2,000 survivors who shared their traumatic stories with the Royal Commission. It shows us that over consecutive governments, over decades, that the people that were in state care and their stories have been largely ignored and not responded to. And so there is so much that we need to take on board here. There is a report now in front of us with recommendations, and all political parties are going to need to take that away and take it very seriously.
How open are you to implementing these recommendations?
That's something that we're going to have to discuss, but we're absolutely open to implementing the recommendations. I think, you know, beyond the state system, there's a lot to do as well. We heard so many stories from people with respect to the racism that they experienced, the discrimination of disabled children that was experienced, and just the failure of the state to exercise that duty of care that all New Zealanders should expect.
This comes at the same time that the government is implementing their state-run boot camps. How do we know what happened won't keep happening?
Well, absolutely, that is the question to ask. And there has been a strong response from survivors, a negative response with respect to the boot camps. And then for many, it is triggering. There are stories in that report of people who were taken to boot camps as part of the care, that even though it's very hard to call it care, that the state was supposed to be providing to them. And the experience that they had was overwhelmingly negative, and they experienced abuse there. And then we have now a government that is going down the same track, implementing a policy that has been proven not to work in the past, and it feels like history on repeat.
Because of this report, there's been many renewed discussions about the state care to prison pipeline. Is this something that could shape your criminal justice and law and order policies?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that all political parties should be looking at their law and order policies with this in mind. You know, we heard in the House yesterday from politicians, but it was reiterating what the survivors of abuse and state care have shared as part of their story, that the trauma they experienced from the abuse led them down paths. Some of them have ended up in prison. There are stories about people going on to become the abuser. Some have ended up in gangs. Some have ended up, you know, just overwhelmingly in the criminal justice system. And so, you know, we have to take on board how people get to these places. And, you know, clearly abuse in state care has played a role in that.
Yesterday, a bill was also dumped when the Minister for Social Development didn't turn up. What happened?
So, very bizarre situation, especially it was the first reading of a bill, and it was very clear that the government parties were fumbling, they were in a shambles, there was chaos. the lead minister, Louise Upston, didn't show up to the House. They hadn't prepared another minister to take up the speech. And so what ended up happening was actually the bill was discharged, which means that it's going to have to be reintroduced to the House before we're able to get onto it. It just is really indicative of how much of a shambles this government is in, and they can't even get the basics right.
What was the bill?
The bill was an amendment bill to the Social Security Act. It was regulatory, so it was technical changes. It wasn't something that was that is overwhelmingly going to make a difference to the welfare system. So it's not one that was going to be opposed by us, and unlikely, I'm not entirely sure, but other opposition parties. And so it was in some ways very non-controversial, and the fact that the minister couldn't show up for a basic piece of legislation like this just goes to show the level of disorganised that the government are.
You said you also had a speech prepared to go yesterday. What would you have spoken to on the bill?
I would have spoken to the fact that they are regulatory changes, that I've looked through the bill, that there seemingly is nothing to be concerned about, that I'd spoken to a beneficiary advocate on this bill, and there had been no concern expressed. I probably would have gone down the path, to be honest, Caden, about talking about things that had nothing to do with the bill, the areas of the welfare system under this government that I am concerned about. But there was not a lot to talk about.
Did you want to talk about the areas of welfare you are concerned about within this government?
Oh, yeah, I would have gone down the track about talking with respect to the significant increase in sanctions, the reduction in hardship support, the target they've set to reduce the number of beneficiaries by 50,000, and yet here they are already up by 20,000. I would have found a way to slip those things in, Caden, even though they weren't necessarily relevant.
That was Labour's Carmel Cipollone on the Abuse in Care Inquiry and the increase in benefit sanctions.
That was our weekly chat with the Labour Party.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
As Auckland Council plans to review its operating model for pools and leisure services, the Public Service Association has criticised moves to privatise management without public consultation. Additionally, Auckland Transport has introduced a $50 fare cap for buses, ferries and trains. Sophia spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about both of these topics.
So there's been calls from the Public Service Association for Auckland Council to stop privatising the management of pools and leisure centres. Firstly, why is Auckland Council looking to review its operating model for these?
Yeah, so the proposal is to essentially contract out the remaining pools and leisure centres that we operate. So we currently operate a mixed model where some of them are contracted to places like YMCA, private providers, and others are provided directly by council. So the move will change that to make them all contracted out. Now, why it's being done is to essentially save money. The evidence has sort of been said to us that will make savings to do this proposal. So that's what's being put forward. Look, I'm just speaking personally, I have a huge amount of sympathy and support for the views of the PSA on this issue. And honestly, I don't see it as a good idea.
Yeah, so there's been concerns about whether this privatised management will prioritise private interests. How will council ensure that under private management, these facilities still accommodate public interests?
Yeah, so how that would work is it kind of works as it does now for the private providers that we do work with. They have to report to the local board, which is kind of the governance arm locally for council, and they have to report against, you know, what customer satisfaction is and all these kind of metrics, right, which we can draft into contracts. So we can say, look, you've got to perform to this standard. You've got to pay staff a living wage. We can put that as part of the contracts, that kind of stuff. They report to local board, and so that would just essentially extend what the current situation there is across the whole city. I think you pointed out something really important there, though, that when we're providing services directly, public have a more direct role in actually managing them and deciding their level of service, right? So we can much easier decide to, say, lower the cost to get in. We can decide to look at the service levels that we provide in terms of pools much more directly if they're directly publicly operated, in my view.
To kind of add on to what you're saying there, another one of PSA's concerns was that this happened without consultation with the public. And I mean, legislation requires the council to review how it delivers its services, but it doesn't have to consult with the public as such. Despite this legislation, how engaged is council in consulting with the public on its decision making like this one?
Yeah, as you pointed out, it's not considered a requirement. It's considered an operational kind of day-to-day decision of council. I think the most direct engagement with the public is through the politicians, like myself. We're voting next week on this proposal, and I just encourage everybody out there to have their say and contact us. All of our stuff's online, emails and phone and things like that. I think that's a really good way of handling it, because, yeah, that is a concern, and there hasn't been provision made to contact the public directly about this issue. And, look, I think that's a legitimate concern. It's an issue of public interest for a lot of people.
And just moving on, I wanted to ask about improving public transport. It's a topic that's caused a lot of daily frustration for Aucklanders. And just this week, Auckland Transport has now introduced a $50 weekly fare cap. Can you briefly tell me a bit about this and how this is addressing some of those concerns held by the public?
Yeah, 100%. The $50 fare cap is one of my favourite topics to talk about. I just got off my WX1 into town. So every week, your fares will cost you a maximum of $50. That's what the fare cap is, starting on Sunday. And so how it will work is, if you're a three-stager like myself coming out of West Auckland, if you're going to town on peak every day for work, you're going to save about $500 a year on your transport bill. That's pretty cool, right? So we need to encourage people from up the sort of suburban and exurban Auckland to actually catch the public transport systems and contribute to lowering climate emissions and all the other positive benefits that you get. So this is the way to do that. And it was also a recognition that fares are actually high relative to the rest of the world, very high if you live 15 kilometres or more out of the city centre. So we need to find a way to lower those fares and to make it affordable for people. So with that $50 cap, you're going to be able to rely your transport budget, if you're taking buses or trains or in a harbour ferry as your transport, you can rely on it being a maximum of $50. I think that's a fantastic step forward for our city.
And as well as the price of fares, Aucklanders are frustrated over the unreliability of public transport due to consistent delays and cancellations. How is this looking to be addressed systemically?
Yeah, I'd sort of make an argument personally that to make sort of the public transport system much more reliable, if you're looking at in terms of buses, you're going to need to look at more bus priority lanes and ways to get buses going through that congestion. I can speak as a Westie about what we're doing about this in Tiaratu, where we essentially we've put in a T2 lane, which is buses as well, and that's actually improving reliability a lot there, because previously there's no point getting on a bus if you're stuck in the same traffic as everybody else, right? We've got to make sure that it's a reliable option for people, more so even than taking the private vehicle. And so this is kind of the thing that we'll be looking at. And I think across the whole city, we need to look at communities and neighbourhoods to see what we can do to unclog the transport congestion issues. Yeah.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson speaking to Sophia about the privatisation of leisure centre management and addressing public transport concerns.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. This is In a Lonely Place from New Order.
We'll be right back.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
United States President Joe Biden has dropped out of the 2024 presidential race. This came after repeated calls from supporters who were worried that they would lose the election if Biden was the Democratic nominee. The presumed replacement for Biden has been current Vice President Kamala Harris, and supporters have rallied behind her this week. I spoke to senior lecturer at the University of Auckland, Dr. Timothy Fagden, about Biden stepping down and the support shown to Kamala Harris so far. Why has Biden pulled out of the presidential race?
Well, it comes down purely to politics for his decision. It became increasingly, inevitable over the last couple of weeks that there was just so much fear that Biden wasn't going to be able to overcome the public perception that he was not up to the job for another 4 years.
And how much pressure for Biden to step down came from internally in the Democratic Party?
That's a good question. I think the sole reason why he ultimately decided to stand down was it was undeniable that there was a widespread and deep pressure from within the Democratic Party. I think Democratic leaders had rallied around him for some time, despite the public perception of him. And it became increasingly obvious after his debate performance, which it's important to add was his idea to have that debate. So depending on which side you're on, it's either was a good thing that he decided to do it and force the issue early so that these changes that have happened, and many have over the last week, taken shape.
There are rumors that it was senior figures such as Nancy Pelosi and even Barack Obama behind convincing Biden to step down. Is this something you'd believe?
I mean, the reporting indicates that that was the case, and it seems no one's denied it. And if you look at the sort of sequencing of things and the public pronouncements that Nancy Pelosi and others made over the last few weeks, I think they were hoping that President Biden would come to the decision without it being out in the open so much, that there was open division and opposition to him continuing. President Biden, understandably, as a seasoned, many decades in politics, a politician, was reluctant to step aside. So it took him some time and talking to family and thinking about things in order to come to the decision. But I ultimately think that despite the high-level private party entreaties to him to step aside, it really took, based on reporting in several outlets, some conversations with Biden in the final weekend that showed some internal polling that basically had showed his path to victory had evaporated completely. So I think at the end of the day, President Biden, as a politician many decades in various roles, looked at the numbers and realized that he was very likely to have his campaign in.
And are we now seeing the party rally around Kamala Harris?
I think if there's one surprising thing in the last, it was how quickly and thoroughly the party seems to have coalesced around Kamala Harris. Politically, that makes sense, but also Kamala Harris has really demonstrated a real ability over the last week to show this unity, to put a more personal face on her, because let's face it, the vice president's job in the United States is a sort of thankless and often private affair. Most people most voters in the country are not that familiar with who the vice president even is. So she's had this wonderful opportunity over the last week to sort of reintroduce herself to people who maybe were familiar with her name from her last campaign for president in 2020, but are now having an opportunity to sort of find out about her anew.
And how have the Democrats' traditional support bases responded to the change?
So far, it has been quite good. There's been a strong support amongst African-American women for Democrats for many, many decades, and they've, for obvious reasons, rallied around Kamala Harris as the first African-American woman to be, inevitably to be nominated, it seems at this point, by a major party for the presidency.
There's reporting even today that as the folks jockey for the eventual vice presidential nomination, the labor unions have already come out, labor union leaders have come out to endorse Kamala Harris and are now trying to exert some influence over the vice presidential selection process. So it seems as though a lot of the traditional constituencies for Democrats have coalesced as well around Kamala Harris's nomination.
Kamala is well known by Gen Z for her popularity in memes. Can her online hype translate into the real world?
That's a really good question. I wrote about this recently with respect to how to engage with and motivate younger voters who I feel, and many who have been studying this issue over the course of this campaign, have been really disengaged and uninspired by both of the leading parties' nominees in former President Trump and President Biden. So I think Kamala Harris's sort of fluency in the space and her ability to connect with these voters could be a critical tipping point, if you will, in breaking through this sort of deadlock in some ways of almost a 50-50 election. Because it's going to be very close no matter what. So if she's able to engage and motivate and inspire these voters through these sorts of social media campaigns, this will be all the better for the Democrats' chances.
And do we know who was on the short list to be her running mate?
Well, they've now started to kick around some names, and there's different opinions, I suppose, as to which way to go. The reporting this week has been overly concerned with the Kamala Harris, first just sort of following up on the Biden bombshell, so to speak, of withdrawing from the race, then asking the question, will the party coalesce around Kamala Harris? And the answer seems to be yes. And then only now do we start to see some movement and some conversations around who might be the, a vice presidential choice. Some candidates, such as Gretchen Whitmer, who's the governor of Michigan, who is, I think, chairing Harris's campaign now, has publicly come out to say that she's not interested to be the vice president, that she wishes to remain as the governor of Michigan and serve in that capacity. However, we know from times past that if a presidential candidate comes and says, hey, your country needs you, that has a sort of the effect of changing people's minds. Gretchen Whitmer, a very popular, successful governor in a swing state that's necessary for the governor's path to victory, certainly would be on anyone's short list. But you also have Josh Shapiro, who's the governor of Pennsylvania, also a swing state governor. He's been very effective in his state, which is, again, a state that can kind of go Republican or Democrat, depending on the cycle. So those are two names to watch, though there are several other really excellent candidates. And I just want to underscore for your audience that the stepping aside of Biden here has really changed the nature of this election. It's brought to the fore a bunch of really top-notch Democratic candidates that I think can offer a freshness to the campaign that didn't exist before and certainly doesn't exist on the Republican side, even with the choice of J.D. Vance, who's a younger senator from the state of Ohio who's been nominated as the vice presidential candidate for Trump. All of the candidates sort of vying at the moment to become a vice presidential candidate for Kamala Harris all bring a freshness. Many of them bring a youth approach. And really a new generation of voters and an opportunity to both shore up the traditional Democratic constituents for Kamala Harris, but also possibly to serve as a firewall in one of these key swing states for the election.
A lot of Democrat supporters are using one word to describe Biden stepping down, which is the word hope. Does that ring true in your opinion?
That there's hope for the Democrats now that he has stepped aside?
Hope for the Democrats, hope for the future, hope for a lot, really.
Yeah. Well, I don't suppose I'd use the same term. I think I understand what some would mean by that. I think people were perhaps justifiably very concerned that the recent polling the circumstances of the last couple of weeks, including the assassination attempt on President Trump, would sort of motivate the Republicans and depress the Democratic voters, that people would start to get in their minds that it was inevitable that the Democrats would lose. So in that sense, his stepping aside has created hope. It's created, I think, more than hope at this stage. Now, it's obviously the honeymoon stage, so to speak, for candidate Harris. The Republican attack machine is still getting into itself into shape to take her on. So it's going to be a very contentious campaign down to the wire. And certainly, if the last two elections are any indicator, will be very, very close. And so I suppose Democrats have a reason to be hopeful in the sense that they've Biden stepping aside has sort of disrupted the way that this campaign was sort of setting up to be, which was kind of a replay of the 2020 election.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Timothy Fagden on Biden stepping down from the United States presidential race and Kamala Harris stepping in as his likely replacement.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Scientists have finally found the clitoris.
The Wire.
Last Friday, 19 July, the International Court of Justice found Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories to be illegal under international law. For the first time, it amounted what Israel is doing to apartheid against the Palestinian people. The court's opinion is non-binding, but can carry immense weight in the international community. It has added pressure for Israel to end their siege on Gaza. I spoke to Kate Stone from Justice for Palestine about the ruling and New Zealand's consequent obligations as a United Nations member state. Can you explain the recent ICJ decision on Israeli apartheid?
So I think just at a really simple level, this is the UN's highest court declaring that Israel's occupation of Palestine is illegal, that its practices in occupying Palestine amount to apartheid, and that all states are under an obligation to bring the situation, the occupation, to an end. I guess in terms of a little bit more detail, the ICJ decision is an advisory opinion. So what that means is that the court is making a declaration of what the legal position is. And it was asked to do this by the UN General Assembly back in late 2022, early 2023. And so the court looked at the question of whether Israel's policies and practices in the occupied Palestinian territories are contrary to international law. And the practices that it was looking at was Israel's ongoing violation of Palestinian rights to self-determination, Israel's prolonged occupation, settlement and annexation of Palestinian territories since 1967, and Israel's adoption of discriminatory laws and measures against Palestinians. And then, depending on how it answered that question, it was to go on and look at how the legality of Israel's ongoing, how those practices affect the legality of Israel's occupation as a whole, and then what that means in terms of the obligations for Israel, the UN, and other states.
Does this decision force any action?
So as an advisory opinion, it's just declaring the law, and its ruling isn't binding as such. But the UN General Assembly requested this opinion. And so the idea here with this type of opinion is that the UN bodies and UN member states would enforce the judgment and take steps to ensure that international law is upheld. So there's a range of things that UN bodies, the General Assembly and the UN Security Council could do, as well as states like New Zealand. There's lots of things that that these parties can do in order to enforce the judgment.
And what has the response been from UN member states?
I guess one thing to say about this process is that in the course of determining this matter. The courts heard from a large number of member states, many of which provided evidence and legal arguments in support of where the court has ultimately ended up. At this stage, there's been that the judgment has been welcomed by both states parties and civil society activists around the world. What the ICJ has said is not necessarily new. What they've done is they've officially declared the legal status, but many UN member states and the UN, its UN bodies itself, and human rights organisations around the world have been saying these things for a long time. So the ICJ decision has confirmed that position and has been clear that states parties now have obligations to act. And so what we've seen is we've seen states parties come out and say they're considering the decision and determining what action they should take. So, for example, we've seen the Foreign Minister of Australia, Penny Wong, come out and say that, you know, to recognise that decision and to say that they are carefully considering what action is to be taken. And so it's really important that our government here in New Zealand does the same. New Zealand is a small state, and we rely on a system of international law that's based on rules, that's based on right rather than might. And so as part of maintaining that system of international law, New Zealand needs to take action to implement this decision.
And what can New Zealand do to uphold the ICJ ruling?
Yes, so there's a whole bunch of things that New Zealand could do. I think firstly, the New Zealand government should come out and make a public statement. This could include a motion in Parliament recognising the court's decision that Israel's occupation is illegal and commit to taking concrete action. And the kinds of action that the New Zealand government could take include ending any existing and prospective economic trade and investment relations with Israel. So part of the ICJ decision is to say that states have an obligation not to do things that might assist in maintaining the occupation. So sanctioning and divesting from Israel and Israel's occupation and things that assist in maintaining that occupation. New Zealand should also recognise the state of Palestine as a step towards recognising Palestinian self-determination and delegitimising Israel's actions that have that violate Palestinian self-determination as found by the ICJ. And if New Zealand was to recognise the state of Palestine, in doing so it would be joining the overwhelming majority of UN member states that already recognise the state of Palestine. And the other thing that New Zealand should be doing is actively working with UN member states to encourage the General Assembly and Security Council to take meaningful steps in response to the ICJ ruling. So, for example, the UN General Assembly could suspend Israel's rights and privileges, meaning that Israel wouldn't be able to participate in sessions of the General Assembly. And this is exactly what happened with apartheid South Africa in the 1970s and contributed to that racist regime becoming a pariah in the international community. And that's the kind of level of action that's required in this situation.
Will what New Zealand does make any difference to Israeli apartheid, considering how small we are?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we saw with the fall of the South African apartheid regime is that there was a building up of pressure from states. It was the big Western powers that held out the longest, but the pressure of all the right-thinking states around the world slowly mounting and making it untenable for big actors like the US and the UK to continue to support that regime. That was what ultimately led to the ending of the apartheid regime, alongside obviously all of the activism and resistance of the South African people. So I think it's incredibly important that New Zealand join many other states around the world that have come out and said what Israel is doing in its occupation of the Palestinian territories, including its blockade and current bombardment of Gaza, is a complete affront to the international system of law and to humanity, and that it must end. And we've seen Ireland, Spain, Norway come out and recognise the state of Palestine, it's clear where the direction of travel is, that parties all around the world are realising that this situation cannot continue and action needs to be taken. And all of these little steps go some way into establishing a situation where we could move to a pathway towards peace for Palestine and Israel and delegitimizing the current regime that Israel is perpetrating against Palestinian people.
And on the topic of South African apartheid, should there be a boycotting of Israel in the Olympics this week, like what happened with South Africa?
Absolutely. I think given what we're seeing on the ground in Gaza at the moment, we need to take every possible action to make it clear that Israel's flagrant violations of international law, international humanitarian law and the human rights of Palestinians is completely unacceptable, and there will be no business as usual. There will be no Olympics as usual. There will be no other sporting events as usual until Israel ends its occupation. That is what this moment demands, and New Zealand, alongside the rest of the international community, needs to be taking action with that level of urgency in this.
That was Justice for Palestine's Kate Stone on the ICJ ruling that Israel is committing apartheid against Palestinians.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B. This is 9 Million Rainy Days from the Jesus and Mary Chain.
Yeah. Damn, I lost another prize because I didn't have my B card number on hand.
I'm bloody sick of you complaining about this every time.
Fine, get a needle and ink. You have a steady hand, right?
Sure.
This is the best idea I've ever had.
You sure you won't regret it?
B cards are timeless. It's the most meaningful tattoo I could get.
Don't you have a tattoo of your grandma?
What's your point?
B card, a quality commitment. Get yours now for just $4.20 a month and be in to win gig and movie tickets, food, vouchers, records, and CDs. Sign up now at 95bfm.com.
Get some floss because you're going to be picking popcorn out of your teeth all August.
Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival, is back for 2024, August 7 to 18.
Tickets are on sale now, so message the group chat, get online and get booking before it starts selling out.
Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival, August 7 to 18. For schedule and tickets, go to nziff.co.nz.
Mixtape was sad. She saw shows with specific themes and thought, who am I? Then one day she realised that she'd been lovingly crafted by her father Sam for a greater purpose, to guide people into their Sunday the right way. She would fulfil her mission, no matter the cost. The Sunday Mixtape. Expect the latest drops, the deepest cuts, and everything in between. The Sunday Mixtape with your host Sam. Sundays 9 till 10 a.m. Right here on 95BFM.
93! 94! 95BFM! 93! 94! 95BFM!
Greenpeace says they are raising the alarm on Fonterra's role in derailing international climate action. This comes after the Netherlands-based Changing Markets Foundations released a report last week outlining the actions of 22 of the biggest meat and dairy companies across four continents. The report highlights Fonterra and the New Zealand livestock industry as key players in a strategy to delay regulation of agriculture emissions. I spoke to Greenpeace spokesperson Sinead O'Flynn about the report and Greenpeace's concerns. I started by asking about Fonterra's role in preventing international climate action.
So Fonterra has been named and shamed in an international investigation by the Changing Markets Foundation that exposes the way that agribusiness corporations globally have been using tactics out of the same playbook as the tobacco industry and the oil industry to delay and derail political action on climate change. And the investigation found that these companies are investing millions of dollars in misleading the public through greenwashing efforts, denying and misrepresenting science, and as well in political lobbying, and that all of this is to downplay their role in the climate crisis and avoid any regulation of their climate pollution.
Is it just Fonterra, or are there other New Zealand companies named in the report?
Specifically, Fonterra is named. They're one of 22 agribusiness companies that have been exposed for their misleading tactics.
In the context of you mentioning that Fonterra was greenwashing, can you talk about what Fonterra calls their positive environmental efforts?
Yes, so Fonterra claims to be the cleanest, the greenest, the most sustainable dairy company globally. But one of the things that this report points out is that there's actually no standard method for measuring or reporting emissions in the agriculture industry. So there's really nothing to substantiate those claims. One of the other things that comes out in this report is the way that Fonterra and Big Dairy here in New Zealand have for two decades now delayed any regulation of the agriculture industry. We've seen efforts in 2003, 2008, 2017, 2022, and then just recently efforts to regulate those industries being kind of dodged and avoided. And that is part of a kind of a global strategy to derail and delay action on climate change.
And how does Fonterra compare to other agribusinesses in other countries?
As I said, because there's no standard measurement for recording and reporting emissions, it is hard to substantiate or to tell. But one thing we do know is that international customers more and more are putting pressure on the New Zealand dairy market to clean up their act. because they're seeing through the greenwash, and their customers have better sustainability expectations than really we are.
Is our government enabling Fonterra to continue doing this through things like the fast track legislation?
So this government absolutely is pandering to and facilitating the climate pollution of Fonterra and Big Dairy. But I will say, it isn't just this government. We've seen successive governments over the last 20 years let them get away with their pollution and a real lack of willpower to regulate and do what is necessary to cut down that climate pollution.
Will Fonterra just keep getting away with this?
No, there is international pressure. Customers expect products to be actually clean and green and more sustainable. So whether our governments are not regulating them and Fonterra have really unambitious climate targets for themselves, eventually the market is going to catch up with them. We're already seeing it. So this change towards more sustainable ecological farming practices is inevitable. And really, the government in Fonterra should now start investing in helping farmers to make that transition.
What does that transition look like? There's been lots of discussions about a just transition. What would this look like for farmers?
Yes, so as we know, Big Dairy is New Zealand's worst climate polluter, and most of that is in the form of methane emissions. The new Merchants of Doubt report states that scientists have said that we need to halve our methane emissions by 2030, and we can't do that without regulating the industry, without reducing herd size, and without investing in supporting farmers to transition towards ecological and plant-based farming.
That was Greenpeace's Sinead O'Flynn on Fonterra's role in preventing international climate action.
BFM. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa e korero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Ngā Pārē Thursday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Eli.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.